You hear that? Your dog knows spring is coming sooner than you think. Dog walks, dog parks, playing fetch, all the stuff your dog loves to do with you. But the warmer weather also means that fleas and ticks are coming back. Fleas and ticks are in the grass, in the woods, and even on their dog friends. Fleas are an itchy nuisance, can easily get into your home, furniture, and beds, which can be terrible. Ticks are even worse. They're hard to spot, but can carry disease and get your dog really sick. PetMeds has your furry friend protected with the best products to prevent flea and ticks all year long. PetMeds pharmacists connect directly with your vet to save you time and deliver the best products for your pet. PetMeds offers low prices on all flea and tick meds, including NexGard, Simparica, and more. And PetMeds AutoShip helps you save even more with additional discounts on regular shipments of PetMeds, dog food, and other high-quality supplies. So get ready for all the spring fun now. Visit PetMeds.com and use promo code PODCAST to save 40% on your first auto ship order. That's PetMeds.com and promo code PODCAST.
I guess I really got in my own world. I didn't think his name would be that big of a meme. So like when it became like a giant meme, I was like, oh, like I already fucked my kid.
I think it behooves most any adult who wants to understand what's going on with the younger generation to try and spend a few hours on TikTok.
There isn't like a tech safety community that's super large. Like it's quite small. You're supposed to be a tortured artist or whatever, but it's like, it's actually kind of edgy to be wholesome at this point.
Artists have the same impact on a community's economic development as entrepreneurs.
The situation in music worries me. Like I know artists that are pretty successful that are like broke. I'm like super into brutalist architecture at the moment. And I thought like brutalist baby, like, you know, like just like a square cement crib would be kind of cool.
Welcome back to Yang Speaks.
It is election day. It's election day 11 or whatever it is. No, I'm kidding.
election day 11, election week two.
Yes.
That's sad.
So I'm getting a lot of questions, Zach, about, hey, like, are these Trump legal actions going to actually succeed? Should we be concerned? I understand why people would be concerned, because you'd put nothing past this administration, but it's a wrap. You know, like
I wanted to debunk, I want to get to facts of the recount nonsense, voter fraud nonsense going on, because it's mostly nonsense. But if you're a game, I'd love your thoughts on what's real and what's truth right now, because the source of truth to me is a moving target right now.
Well, the truth is that Joe has a margin of victory in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, that's high enough that it's going to make a recount like impossible to succeed. Wisconsin, where I think it was Scott Walker, the Republican governor of Wisconsin, who said, look, we can make a mistake of 100, 200, 300, maybe 400 votes. We're not going to make a mistake of 20,000 votes. You know, like, you know, it's like we know how to count. And this is a Republican governor. You know, so
who's been pro-Trump in some ways, you know, or anti-Biden, so, if you will.
Like a lot of these states have Republican secretaries of state. Georgia, Republican secretary of state. Pennsylvania, Republican secretary of state. Mm-hmm. Like they're the folks. So what's happening is you have very hyper-partisan impulses being like, it's a fraud, you screwed up. And then when the show will be like, okay, like, what evidence are you claiming? They'll like just snatch some strange, like, you know, account or video that most often gets explained away, or accounts for, you know, like maybe like 1 to 10 votes where you could be like, okay, maybe like that. But like there's no claim of like, and then they dumped 25,000 fake votes in there and put it like, you know, like there's nothing that would influence the outcome of the election. So here's what's really going on. The Republicans know they've lost, but they need Donald Trump's voters through January 5th, the Georgia special elections, which we'll talk about. And you and I are heading to Georgia.
Yes, sir.
Shortly. So that's exciting.
Not to vote ourselves, to help other people vote. I'm going to say that.
Yeah, yeah.
Times.
Just to draw attention and raise money and rally. But, you know, not going to. That. Yeah, no, it really is. It's like there's like a.
It is not Andrew Yang's fault or my fault that Georgia's laws on voting residency are ridiculous. Apparently you can move there and just register to vote. That's ridiculous. Not our fault. Not our plan. Keep going.
Yeah, no, exactly. Take it up with the Georgia state legislature. So, so the Republicans have reasoned that they need Trump's voters January 5th. And so they're going to play along with the entire Trump fraud game. Because they just want to maintain energy levels, because they think if Trump's just out of the picture and he concedes, then all of his supporters will stay home January 5th, and the Democrats have a better chance of winning these special elections. But I think you said, Zach, that what's telling is that Trump and Pence are essentially on vacation now. You know, they're like chilling. Like everyone in their administration is looking around being like, okay, I guess I need a new job. And then their leadership is like, you have to pretend that everything is still normal, that we'll be here, and if you don't, then we'll fire you before even like you can leave. So that's the situation. It's cynical, it's political, like a lot of things in American life, it's trying to maintain hold of the Senate January 5th.
So here's my thought on this stuff. Is would that make sense to me? And then for those of you like, because I think disinformation becomes a problem when rational Republicans, who are not the diehard base, but like rational moderate Republicans or moderate libs on the other side, start to parrot what the far right or far left is saying. And I think that's what's happening here. It's really frustrating because I have, you know, rational pundits or rational friends of mine. They're like, well, there seem to be some shenanigans going on, which is frustrating because here's what's up. That I like recounts. So if like the Republicans want to just say, hey, we want to recount the votes, fine. Totally fine. We should do that in democracy. I'm 100% on board. We did it. We've done it before. We'll do it again. But here's the counts are Biden's ahead by 20,000 votes in Wisconsin, 145,000 in Michigan, 13,000 in Arizona, 14,000 in Georgia, almost 50,000 in Pennsylvania. So some of these are close, but not a couple signatures
and,
off.
And
close,
note, even if there was a freakish thing where one of them gets overturned, Joe still wins. Like you need to correct. Overturn several of them.
Yes. So Joe essentially needs three, maybe two, depending on which ones you pick here. I think with Pennsylvania and Georgia, I believe it's over, right? By the math. So the other thing is this is the other fact of the case, because Republican lawyers and judges, generally speaking, 99.9% of them believe in the rule of law. And they're looking at this, not a single judge, all judges have thrown out the cases presented to them that have been at the scale that could flip the election, right?
Because like there's
the
no evidence of it.
The only ones that have been accepted, right?
It's clearly just like
accepted over the small ones.
Yeah.
So there's no real evidence at all of voter fraud. And that is frustrating. This election is baked, guys. It happened. Joe Biden got more votes, both nationwide and the states he needed. He's the president-elect. Donald Trump's on the way out.
And the Republicans would be acknowledging this to a much higher degree if not for the special elections in Georgia, in my opinion. So,
you're probably right.
So just keep in mind that like they see the
there's an incentive
balance of power in the Senate as potentially at stake, and then that's made them much more willing to play along.
Right. And that makes their life hell, comparatively speaking, right? Like they have a lot of incentive to want power in their power in the Senate, because then Congress actually can do stuff.
Well, Democrats need, you know, it's like, yeah, Republicans need
both
the,
of them, right?
Need the leadership. Yeah. I mean, they both need it.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. I think this is a fun, Trevor Noah had this point, which I don't always love Trevor Noah, but sometimes he's funny. He said, so on one hand, this claims of voter fraud are hurting democracy and our trust in elections, and something you've talked about a lot. On the other hand, on a more fun hand, there is a chance we see Donald Trump dragged out of the White House, which I think would be funny from a comedy standpoint and an entertainment standpoint, which I think is Trump's lane. Like, I think he's an entertainer to me. Thoughts on that? What you'd rather see? I imagine I know where you land, but have you thought
he's not
going to
let us
like
get dragged out? He's going to walk out of there like the day before. and do a photo op and like hop in a helicopter or plane.
Give us the bird, yeah. Flip us the bird and have Ed.
Yeah.
I think you're probably right.
And then millions of Americans will continue to support him. And then, you know, we'll see what his future holds. The problem really is like the muddiness between now and then, because still he's the president between now and then. So he's firing people. He's making decisions.
He's fired his secretary of defense, right? Who said, if it's a yes man, God help us all.
The transition's getting gummed up because ordinarily the Biden team would have some resources to work with and be talking to current officials and a bunch of other things. And that has not happened. So that's negative substantively for an effective trade-off of or handoff of power. And that sucks, you know, there's no bones about it. Like this, like we just hung on through this and like, it's still happening where you have, like you said, I guess, formerly reasonable Republicans being like, oh, like, let's play this out. Like, it's bad for the country that the incoming team cannot talk to the current team. It's bad for the country that millions of Americans are being called to like question the objective fact of who got more votes. Like this stuff's really destructive and it's speeding up. You know, it's like the norms just held together for this one. You know, next time, if the next person says this stuff is rigged, like, you know, you might see unrest and like worse judging or, you know, whatever the heck, you know, it is. So like, this is not going well for American democracy. You know, like, I'm thrilled that Joe and Kamala won, but and I wish that, you know, Republicans didn't have these political incentives to cast this like alternate version of reality where clearly, and like all these Republicans are being like, oh, they're like issue shenanigans, they could do a recount. If Trump had won, they would be crowing immediately, being like, you know, it's in the bag, stop it, like, we don't need to count more, like the rest of it. I mean, you saw it so clearly where like the chant was different depending upon what state and what the needs were. It was like, stop the count or count every vote or whatever it was, you know they'll like flip on the dot.
It's a tough argument because there's so many states.
The core of it is just that they want their team to win, and that's in some ways understandable because we all want our teams to win. But you know, at this level, like, that there has to be some degree of country over party. You know, it's like this stuff is really bad for the country. It's bad for the country that an incoming government like can't talk to the current government. It's bad for the country that like you have this floundering executive branch for, you know, two solid months. Like, you know, like there are just real, real negatives to this. I think this handholding of Republicans who want to play along is corrosive. You know, like I wish they didn't feel, I guess it's like the epitaph to the Trump era. It's like, well, we kind of wish Republicans had separated from him this entire time and been like, yo, this guy's, you know, not the guy, and they never did. And so they're still playing it out. They're still riding his Trump coattails to what they hope is political victory in Georgia. Country be damned. You know, it's a sad day or a sad week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it is.
You know, you've talked a lot. I'm going to find this quote and tweet it before this podcast where you said we're entering an era. I think you said this at CNN Town Hall, your first one, where you said we're entering an era of the lack of institutional trust, where we don't trust our schools, we don't trust our military, we don't trust our education system, and we don't trust government. And now it's looking like we don't trust our elections.
We don't trust the media.
Final straw. We don't trust media. Yeah, there's like a whole bunch on this list. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, Zach, military is the most trusted of those institutions you just named. Like,
of course I butchered your quote. That's actually a good example.
No, it's fine. I mean, like the military is like the last bastion that gets like majority trust. We don't trust hospitals. We don't trust doctors. Yes. Don't trust. You know, it's like the trust is low. The trust is declining further. Still, this election, unfortunately, has not been good for trust.
You've talked about this before, but I'm we never really debated it. So there's liberal chatter, and not like far left stuff. It's like Politico wrote about this, where there's rumors that Trump will have some civil suits and possibly face jail time from certain courts when he leaves the White House. And you've been on record saying you hate that because that turns us into Venezuela. And I agree with that.
No, I hate criminal prosecution. The civil suits have at it, you know, he owes you money, yeah, go for it. Right. You know, I mean, I do think it's bad practice for a new government to like throw the previous president in jail, you know, because that's a pattern that goes on in developing countries where like the new president's always trying to like chase down the former president who's still a potential threat. Yeah. And I know there are going to be many people who disagree with this because they want to see Trump in jail really, really badly. I think it would be, I would think it would do more harm than good to try to imprison Trump. And I also think that, again, just like the odds of seeing him dragged out of the White House, the odds of him actually going to jail would be so low. You know, he would just decamp to another country where he would live it up.
Right. Yeah. Nope. But I do think, like, if he owes money, like, particularly the New York
civil suits have at it. On taxes, he owes you money. Go for it.
Like, come on.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
So let's get to Georgia. Why is everybody going to Georgia over the next, call it, 2 months?
You had not one but two Senate races in Georgia, which is highly unusual. And neither of the quote-unquote winners or frontrunners got 50%. So in Georgia, there's a rule where if you don't get 50%, you go to a runoff. So race number one is John Ossoff against David Perdue. And that was close. It's a two-point race or so. John Ossoff's very young, very logical, really impressive candidate to have accomplished so much. I talked to him the other day, and he was joking about how when he ran for Congress, it ended up being like the most important congressional race of the year because it was the first one post-Trump. And then now his Senate race is becoming the most important. So he's like joking. He's like, I'm just lightning striking twice. And then the other race is Reverend Raphael Warnock against Kelly Loeffler. And both Perdue and Loeffler were accused of insider trading on coronavirus information. When they first found out how bad the coronavirus was going to be, they did what any American would do and adjust their stock portfolio. They were just like, oh, this is going to be bad for cruise lines. You know, it's like, that's leadership. That's leadership.
So illegal, by the way. It's so, having worked on Wall Street, that is like textbook insider trading. There's not, like, that's not even a gray area.
Yeah, the entire legislative access to tradable information, I mean, come on, like, we haven't figured this one out. Like, if you're gonna show up in Congress, just like put your money in a trust, they like throw it in a bunch of things, you can't touch it, and then you come out of public service, you get it back. Instead, we're creating all of these gray areas where legislators are freaking profiting. It is not a good look that folks enter Congress non-millionaires and leave millionaires on the regular, you know, like that. That's, and it happens all the time.
And it makes sense because it's not illegal to do this. You go in and sit there in a meeting like, wow, it looks like this massive XYZ problem is causing oil prices to skyrocket in the Middle East. Like, oh, better like get out of my oil companies, and you go in there and you make your trade and then let it go. And then, yeah, you don't lose all that money. And like, there's a moral, like, take care of your family thing, but it's highly illegal. It's not cool.
I mean, Congress hasn't slammed the door on this stuff to the degree that it could.
That it needs to, right.
It needs to, for sure. I mean, it'd be illegal in some of these other contexts you're talking about.
All that depends, but there needs to be rules, and like, insider trading's hard to track in general, but this one's easy. This one's easy.
Well, Zach, I'll tell you, the enrichment of congressional members is not strictly that they just have better intel and they're like, you know, like adjusting their E-Trade portfolio or something like that. Most of it is that you get in there and then all of a sudden, like, people just want to include you in everything, including things that that can make you some money. And they're technically legitimate. But just people will be like, hey, you know, like, we've got some real estate deal. Like, you want to come, like, partake? And, like, there's no rule against it. You're, like, you know, a citizen. You can invest. And so people will just be, like, trying to carve out awesome opportunities for you. And then before you know it, like, you know, you're trouncing the market many, many times over. If you're a member, too, you're, like, hanging out with rich people all the time. And then the rich people kind of put their hand on your shoulder and are like, they're there. Like, we like you. You should be rich like us. And then the members are like, yes, I should. And then before you know it, they are. Anyway, this is actually a long digression from the fact that...
No, it's very real, man. And I'll say this quickly because I saw this. Like, if you have... People always like, the rich get richer, like, poor, poor. Like, when you have money, the investment opportunities get a lot better and a lot less risky. In the sense that in 2000, I'll never forget this, we sold an Apollo European Credit Fund. Awesome idea. And basically in the 2009 financial crisis, all like the smaller banks, mid-level banks in Europe went under. So private citizens, if you're like the Cisco, which is like the food delivery service, super blue chip company, you couldn't get a loan in Europe. So private citizens just pulled a bunch of money together and were loaning like blue chip companies at like 11% interest, 15% interest. It was the closest thing to a surefire bet ever. And all you had to do was have enough money to lock it up. So it's stuff like that, that they're getting access to, where you and I, like, you're poor, you're not in the game. You have to invest in just an Apple stock or whatever, S&P 500, and like go with those waves. These guys get sure things, at the lead access, that kind of stuff. So long way to getting there, but that's just one that I remember very vividly. Man, I'm like, wow, this is a no-brainer if I had money. You know?
Yeah, and then they'll call you up and be like, hey, I got a thing for you.
I so got Kelly a deal Loeffler, for you.
Yeah. And then you're like, sure, you feel smart, and it's corruptive over time. Anyway, Kelly Loeffler is the richest member of the Senate, which is saying something, because there are a lot of freaking rich senators. But Kelly Loeffler is worth $520 million. She's already put $23 million into her race. Reverend Raphael Warnock, is a black reverend. Very inspiring. Like, he's getting a lot of support. I'll just say because I think it's fun, is that Kelly Loeffler also owns a WNBA team that, like, and all the players wanted her to sell it because she was against the Black Lives Matter messaging, like, on the court. Like, you know, it's like, you probably should do everyone a favor and sell that team if, like, your players don't want to play for you that way. So that's the other race. These are fascinating races. And we have to be realistic that for Democrats, it will be an uphill climb. And you think, well, why? Because didn't Joe just win this state? Like, isn't Georgia purple? The problem is that Republicans in Georgia have a much tighter read on voting and the need to vote than Democrats, who many of them are new to the process. And this was true a number of years ago. Even there was a special election that was very close to get to a special election. It was maybe a 3-point gap, and then the Republican won it by double digits, maybe 12 points. So that was a number of years ago. So it's probably not going to be that gruesome this time. But you have to expect that Democrats will come out at lower levels. And the Trump not being on the ballot thing cuts both ways, is that they're like, you know, Republicans are concerned that their voters will stay home. You know who will stay home? A lot of anti-Trump Democratic voters in Georgia. So it's an uphill climb, but we have to make this happen, because the alternative is Mitch McConnell saying no to everything for 4 years while the country sinks into the mud. That's why I'm heading there and you're heading there, is that we have such massive problems in this country, and we know Washington will take any excuse not to work. You know, if the party can just look and blame the other side, being like, well, nothing happened, no stimulus bill, It's their fault. Vote them out of office, and then go eat a steak, while the, you know, the country is burning. They'll do that. You know, that's, I mean, that, like, that, like, I mean, we're seeing it, we're feeling it.
We've already felt it for 7 months.
Yeah, for 7 months. So if you want to get things done out of Washington that might help people, a unified government would be enormously superior to Mitch McConnell saying no, no, no. And Mitch McConnell, all of a sudden, you know, he's going to be like, oh, the deficit. Like, when, like, no one cared when Trump was like, let's do a, like, $1 trillion tax cut. It'd be like, yeah, let's, you know, like,
for all the Republicans that voted because of the fiscal situation in the United States to decrease the deficit, it went up exponentially. Essentially, Donald Trump had the biggest increase of deficit in a long time. I'm gonna see if I pull those numbers up, but go ahead. So it's bullshit. It's a bullshit argument.
Like, and if there's any time you're gonna deficit spend, it's when you have a pandemic and a pandemic-induced recession and a jobs recession, and, like, you know, like, people are getting kicked out of homes and in food bank lines. Like, if there's any time you're going to deficit spend, it would be now. And one of the things that frustrates the heck out of me is the confusion around where the money is going. CARES Act, $2.2 trillion. If you do the math, $1,200 for, let's call it, 100 million Americans, is something like 6% of $2.2 trillion. So it's like, oh, all the money went to people? No, you know, like a tiny sliver went, like, you could give everyone $1,200 a month for a year with, like, that $2 trillion if you so chose, which, by the way, would have been vastly superior to what they did. Because let's say you have an airline. I feel very deeply and desperately for all the families, you know, the furloughed employees and the rest of it. But let's say that all those employees were getting, like, $1,000 a month, $2,000 a month, and then the airline itself was getting recapped. Like, then how would you feel? We only care about the airline because we care about the workers. We care about, like, the pilots, the airline attendants, like, the rest of it. It's like, I don't want those people to suffer. Yeah, no, like, I don't want those people to suffer. It, you know, the other thing is, like, we have a sophisticated enough corporate infrastructure where, like, a bankrupt airline will just keep on flying anyway. You know what I mean? They'll go to the creditors and be like, well, I can't make any money if we're not doing flights. And they'll be like, yeah, yeah, you go do that. Like, it's not like bankrupt firms just stop operating. You know, like, the creditors can just keep on, you know, like, doing the thing. So there are many, many better ways to go. So even if you are concerned about the deficit, you should be clamoring for cash relief because it is the most effective bang for your buck. It would actually go right back into the economy. It would rejuvenate small businesses, keep some of these restaurants open, and all the rest of it. And so having Mitch McConnell talk about the deficit is something I will fight tooth and nail to shut him up. Just be like, look, just, you know, like, just step aside. You've done enough wrecking of the country for a while, you know, like, let's try and rebuild it.
Yang versus Mitch. I'm excited for this. So those, just to make sure I get the numbers right. This is according to a site called The Balance, which is like a pretty, I've read this before, but a pretty good, US debt, blog website. But we've increased the debt by Donald Trump under Donald Trump's been 36% or so, almost 36% in the past 4 years. Now you could give a chunk of that, kind of, not all that is COVID right now. A lot of that is the tax cuts. And there's this logic on the right that say, hey, if we cut taxes, people will make more money without the taxes, and then they'll still make it back. And the reality is really rich people don't pay taxes. So this is a ridiculous model. So that's our world right now. And then to be clear on this, if the Democrats win these two Senate races, we have a 50-50 tie in the Senate, which means a tiebreaker goes to the sitting vice president, which means Kamala Harris.
Which is going
to
be Kamala Harris. So
then we have a 51-50 advantage.
So would that not be glorious? That's what's on the line in Georgia. That's why we're heading there. We've just kicked off winbothseats.org, which donates to 16 community organizations that activate voters in Georgia and in different places and different communities. So we've identified this as the most effective use of resources. It's a 2-month sprint, and so you need people that can actually talk to people. And these orgs do just that. They're actually very close to the ground. So you know, we're going to go there too, knock on doors, like do some things. I'm going to try and activate some people while I'm there. It's been fun where a lot of people have reached out to me being like, yeah, you're going to be in Georgia. Like, you know, we'd love to get together.
T.I. retweeted you, which is hilarious.
Yeah, Martin Luther King III said, yeah, let's get lunch. I mean, like, you know, that it's like, oh, there's like a beautiful, yeah, there's a beautiful welcome wagon in Georgia, which is a great place. Dominique, like, freaking love Dominique.
Oh yeah, Dominique, we'll see him in Atlanta. Dominique Wilkins. So a couple things. I'll say this again, I keep saying it, but I do think it's important because a lot of the right is like screaming this narrative, if you will, where Georgia has some weird residency laws. And let me say this before, if you move there, you can pretty much vote pretty immediately, which is not great when, you know, potentially for election fraud. But to think of how that would actually work, where people actually move, get a place, and then move out for an election, it's not going to happen at scale. But that's not the point. We are going there to help the campaigns, to help the Democratic Party, to get out the vote and register new people to vote. So that's what we're doing. More to come. I mean, guys, we've now turned these campaigns, which are probably, what, 30, I don't know the numbers at the top of my head, $30 to $50 million operations each. Now it's going to be combined hundreds of million dollar operation where the whole nation is now focused on the state, whether they like it or not. So a lot is up in the air. We're figuring out what we're going to do. All we know now that we're moving there and we found some great orgs to work with, and so TBD. It's also COVID, which we'll talk about a little bit on this podcast. So the in-person campaigning, not as fun as it was back in Iowa in January. But let me ask you this, Andrew. I think this is really important. Because a lot of people see you, I like to call your lane the rational progressive, right? Where you're not far left, but you have really big ideas. And you're not afraid to talk, to criticize both parties. You clearly are a Democrat. You lean left on a whole bunch of things, almost everything. But you also are very rational and thoughtful. Not left or right, forward is kind of what, you know, that's been our slogan. 70 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. There is a... To me, it's also a healthy sign that we're not all, like, the country's very divided. So what are you're right now very supportive of giving Joe and Kamala full reign of the House and Senate, which is why we're going to Georgia. Do you mind explaining, like, why a little more? You touched on a little bit, but why are you, even though there were so many Trump supporters here that we saw it wasn't a mandate, why you're so passionate about the full control for Joe?
I understand that there's some people that are like, ooh, you know, both parties, checks and balances, compromise.
Yeah, it'd be
like,
nice to have the balance.
You don't want to give everything. Yeah, like, I understand that perspective. I think we're in a very specific situation right now where we have a pandemic that is getting worse, not better. We have a $3 to $4 trillion hole in our economy. Something like 40 million plus Americans have filed for unemployment over the last period of time. And so the government needs to be taking fairly dramatic measures in order to stop the bleeding and fill that hole and provide a path for tens of millions of Americans. Now, if you look up at Washington's recent history, it's not great in terms of taking the actions I'm describing, but the track record plummets when you have Mitch McConnell playing goalie or obstructionist. So if we lived in a world where the Republicans and Democrats have been working together harmoniously and like hammering out legislation, and then you were in this crisis and you had confidence that they would come together, then maybe, you know, it's like, okay, like that might make sense. But that's not the world we live in. Like, we live in a world where we haven't gotten another relief act in 7 months and counting, and it's probably going to be, you know, unfortunately, like, significantly longer because they're not going to pass a law in the lame duck session. And in this circumstance, you need an invigorated government actually doing things. I know it's painful for some people to hear, but that's where we are. Half of independent restaurants are going to close without some kind of relief. Like, think about what that means for communities around the country, for those jobs, those people, those families that freaking spent a lifetime building that restaurant, put their heart and soul into it, and now are going to be forced to shut it forever. I mean, like, that's what we're facing unless our government actually, passes the Relief Act for restaurants, small businesses, puts money into people's hands. Like, the deprivation and desperation are rising. And this is not the time to be like the bipartisanship you're talking about is an abstraction. Like the reality has been sorely disappointing for years and years. And so if we're going to get some kind of real action out of Congress, we have a much better chance at it if Mitch McConnell is not the final say.
I think that was extremely well put. I think the other, to me, what I look at is you start to give Joe options, because Joe can go to Mitch, say, hey, I'm willing to negotiate with you so you can get your moderate Republicans on board with a bill that all Americans can get behind. But if not, I'm going to force something through. Like, that to me is what a reasonable president can do, and I think Joe will be. So that is why we're going to Georgia. That's why this matters. Once we have details and you can, or you get off your butt and get down there. But if not, also, like, we can phone bank, you can text bank, you can fundraise. There's a whole bunch of virtual things you can do as well. So this is where the focus is. With that, we have a really special guest, man. This is like, we've been excited about this for literally Grimes. 6 months.
Yeah, like... I'm such a huge Grimes fan on a personal level and a creative level. She's just a powerhouse. We met on the trail, stayed in touch, and she became a mom. And, you know, I dare say, you know, like, that, she's been, fairly low profile since. So like, this was like a special treat, on several levels, but I just love talking to her, and she has so much to offer, a lot of insight. I think the world right now needs more art and uplift, and that stuff's underestimated, really. Like, you know, you talk about politicians trying to be a source of that, but I think artists are a more consistent source of that in the vast majority of people's lives. You know what I mean? It's like, if you want to feel good, like, what do? You probably turn on your favorite artist. You turn on your favorite music. Like, you probably don't turn on, like, old Obama speeches or something. You know, maybe you do.
No,
some people
they
do.
Don't turn to Yang. Maybe they laugh. Maybe they turn to Yang Speaks. I don't know.
So
but you're right. Yeah, it's music.
Yeah, so just learn a ton. But more importantly, just, like, felt a real sense of joy getting to catch up with Grimes. I hope other people enjoy this conversation too. So thank you, Grimes. Hope everyone enjoys it. It was a treat for me.
Yeah. And look, she doesn't do a lot of these. So it's a rare moment. And I learned a lot. And I think you guys are going to enjoy it. So tune in. Grimes joins Yang Speaks.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought, if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15 year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. It is my thrill to welcome to Yang Speaks award-winning musician, visual artist, creative extraordinaire, Grimes. Welcome. Oh my gosh, Grimes. It's so great to see you.
Thanks for having me. How's it going?
Thank you. It's going 2020 good, is what I say. You know, it's like I can't complain, but the world is terrible. You know, I mean, the world is a little bit less terrible now that Joe has defeated Trump and is heading toward the White House. But that election, I know you and I texted about this, like, it didn't leave you with a positive feeling.
No, it was, I mean, it was definitely a high stress situation, I think. Yeah, but I don't know. I feel like there are lessons to be learned from this.
Well, for you, you grew up in Canada. Does American politics horrify you, fascinate you? Like from someone who grew up in our northern neighbor, which seems like a more rational place in many ways. Like how do you experience American politics that way?
Well, first of all, I feel Canada isn't actually as rational as everyone thinks. You know, we are the home of the crack mayor, Rob Ford.
That guy.
Who like got caught smoking crack and then got caught smoking on video and then got caught smoking crack like again and then possibly like a third time. So, you know, it's like we're not that much better. And actually Canadian politics are, I think, a bit more crazy than people think just because we have a kind of like a three-party system. So a lot of the times the more kind of, I don't know, woke vote or whatever actually gets kind of split between the Liberals and NDP. So Canada actually has its own problems, but, you know, which often leads to a conservative government. We still have like healthcare and like our colleges massively subsidized, which is like, it just actually does make a huge difference in quality of life.
You're a product of that, right? Because Canada's universities, including the top public universities like McGill, are essentially cost free. Yeah. And I think like you attended, was it McGill or like one of the Canada's big schools?
Yeah, no, I attended McGill, which is literally like a fantastic school, like almost for free, like a couple thousand dollars a year or whatever. And I'm deeply grateful for that, even just because you can kind of not know your major going in and stuff. Like, I feel like in America, if you make the wrong choice with your major or career, like it can be like a hundreds of thousands of dollars mistake.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. Yeah, it's true.
Yes. So it's like, I mean, that's just, I don't know. I kind of didn't fully comprehend the situation until I came to America and met people. And it was like, damn, like I got to like try out a few different things before I, you know, chose my major. So
I think this is one of the main reasons we think Canada is more rational, is that your education is paid for and you're not taking 18, 19 year olds and loading them up with debt and then stressing them out about making life decisions when they should be exploring.
Yeah. I mean, I like did not know what I wanted to do at 18 or 19, like absolutely not. You know, so, well, actually I did want to be a musician, but, I didn't think that was a reasonable career path to pursue. So it ended up working out. But yeah, no, it's like, it just seems crazy that you should be saddled with an insane amount of debt for decisions you're making before you even really know who you are.
Before your brain is fully wired. Seriously, it's highly nonsensical. And people are paying for it here. So you knew you wanted to be a musician. Did you have a sense of the medium? Like, did you think, it's going to be electronic or, you know, you'd be the vocalist, or did you dabble with instruments, or what was the story there?
I actually never made music because I didn't think I could or should. But I was just like an obsessive music fan, like super, super, super obsessive. And then actually in my neuroscience course, or I was in I was sort of studying music in the brain. And we actually had a class where we had to learn logic and like make a song overnight and bring a song to class the next day to prove we'd like learned the audio recording software. And that's when I kind of started making music, because the class provided free audio software. And then I just sort of like went down the rabbit hole.
Whoa, that is wild. Yeah. What year in college is that? How old are you?
That would have probably been 2009 or 2010. And then I basically, the first music I made kind of went viral, which was both a blessing and a curse, because like there's a lot of footage of me like it literally learning how to make music. I've been making music for less than a year and I'm like on stage and stuff. there's some pretty awkward video of me like being like, I accidentally turned the SP404 off, sorry guys. And people, but yeah, so.
Well, certainly at that point your career starts taking off and you end up making a career move, which anyone would have in your position. I think the most fascinating thing about your music is that
It really feels like you're transported to another world. Like, I actually...
Have you actually listened to my music?
I have actually listened to your music, but I will confess to you, Grimes, that, like, if I just listen to your music, I feel like I'm not getting the right experience. Like, I feel like I have to be watching the video in order to be... Like, I'm not sure how many of your fans feel the same way, but...
I mean, I kind of feel that way, so I don't know. I'm glad you feel that way, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, because you're such a visual artist, and there are such striking visuals. Again, you feel transported to another world with like a lot of your videos and songs, and so I feel like they all go together in a way that makes them more complete. Like if I'm just listening to the music in a car or whatnot, like I just feel like, although let me wait until I can be someplace and like watch the video on my phone. I don't know if that's everyone's attitude, but for whatever reason, that's the way I've experienced your music.
I mean, I'm usually thinking of videos, like almost all my best songs. Imagine a scene or something, because I direct a lot of the videos myself or co-direct them with my brother, and then kind of make the song around that. So it is, I think, core to the music. And speaking of the Canadian government, part of the reason I was able to even do that in the first place, like being super small and on an indie label, was the Canadian grant system, which America is maybe too big to have art grants. I don't know, but that's another thing that I super appreciate about being born.
I didn't know this, but what an incredible story. You're like the product of the public education system, and then you had some kind of art grants to make some of your first videos that helped launch you. So there are programs like that in the United States, but not in the way you're describing. I don't believe, like, anyone who's an artist listening to this is like, I haven't seen an art grant in my life in the United States. The people who are saying that are generally correct. There is a national endowment for the arts, but it would not go to an independent musician that's trying to make a video. Like it might go to a museum or an art display. Not that there's anything wrong with those things. But that's an incredible story of the government coming through.
I know that's why I'm like, I mean, if you look at the American music in general, like so many of the artists are Canadian or Swedish or whatever, you know, like I do think there is, you can like see a direct correlation between the grant system and public funding for the arts and, you know, like, I don't know, whatever, The Weeknd, Bieber, it's Drake, you know.
I was just at Saturday Night Live and I was hanging out with Jim Carrey, and it just struck me that he's another super Canadian who like came down and took over showbiz. So it's true, like the Canadian influence is very strong everywhere. One of the things that I found out when I was running this entrepreneurship organization, Venture for America, was that artists have the same impact on a community's economic development as entrepreneurs. Like if a bunch of artists move to a community and then you wait X years, that community will end up having economic growth, new businesses, revitalization in the same way as if a group of entrepreneurs went. And this is a major problem for the United States, because in the United States, arts are treated not as an economic driver, but as something of a luxury or frivolity, because of what you're describing, where you show up to college and then anyone who says they're going to study art or music would be like, are you out of your minds? And, people get funneled towards, quote unquote, these more practical things. When in truth, and you and I talk about this, like in the future, we have to be investing much more energy in arts and creativity. Because AI and technology are going to do a lot of like the bookkeeping and accounting and like the practical stuff that people feel like is a safer career. I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to change pretty quickly.
Yeah. Although I do actually think like at least music is democratizing really fast, in part due to the tech companies, like, GarageBand being free on an Apple computer or whatever. I think you can actually record, like, I think like Billie Eilish said she recorded her album in her house or whatever. Like it is, the technology is kind of getting to a place where I think it's just getting a lot more democratic. Like you don't need, it used to be that you needed to be just really fucking rich or on like a label that's going to spend, hundreds of thousands of dollars to make an album. And I think it's interesting because you're just seeing the amount of artists making music ballooning right now, which is cool, but then it's its own drama. Because I was actually just talking to Daniel Ek, who runs Spotify, and they're like, you know, there's 7 million artists on Spotify or whatever. And like, they feel like they can like maybe make it so that like 1 million artists can make a living off music, which is still
not a lot. 7 million. Yeah.
Not 7 million. I'm probably, it's going to like double, like it's, there's probably gonna be more than 7 million. But I don't know. Like, I wonder, I mean, I know you're really into like UBI and stuff. Like, I wonder if there's ways to, like, if everything is automated, like if there's sort of AI and machines kind of like doing almost every sort of menial job or whatever, like, is there a world in which if companies aren't paying employees, they can like tax, they can be taxed more, like because of all the extra, in theory, all the extra revenue they'd be making while not having to pay, and like, you know, could that be like, I don't know. I'm actually curious about like UBI. Like, I haven't read that much about it. Like, I'm not like, I don't know what the specifics would be, like how it would be accomplished or whatever.
I'm really passionate about a lot of elements of this, where right now, so, and you know this much better than I do, and you're like an ultra successful popular artist, but a lot of artists are dependent upon actually performing live and touring in order to make money, make a living. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Even and, me, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, for you too. I mean, like, you understand this better than I would. But the digital royalties from like a Spotify are really, really pretty minimal, even for folks who are getting tons and tons of downloads and views. Like, I forget what the math is, but it's something like a, I don't know, like a tenth of a penny or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like maybe you get a few cents. And so there are artists who might get millions of downloads who are struggling to get by.
Because, you know, it's like, it's actually, yeah, it's pretty insane. I mean, I wouldn't say it's just an issue with the streaming services. I think the labels are a huge part of this too. I mean, in music, there's just a lot of middlemen. Like, you know, once you have like, you know, business management, lawyer, manager, booking agent, label. Personally, I think labels pay too much, but at the same time, you know, a label is also, can also throw a lot of money down on an artist and it can fail. So it's like, I'm not really sure what the solution is, but I do, the situation in music worries me. Like, I know artists that are pretty successful that are like broke.
And that's not right. Yeah. You know, like these are folks who are,
like people with millions of plays, like they're like popular artists. Like, so it's yeah. I feel like we need to sort of like do something about the middleman situation, but then
there is a cost structure where you have an industry that came of age in a time when there was a lot more money flowing through. Because I'm old enough to remember going to Tower Records and like the CD stores and whatnot, you know, that they were like buying this. Don't lie. A lot of times you were buying an album for like one or two good songs too. It was like, you know, like the way it was packaged. So you do have some legacy costs. Another big problem, though, is that we've conditioned consumers to pay one streaming fee, and that's it. You know what I mean? It's like, if I paid for Spotify, then I want all my music for free. And then the only way you can get more money out of them is to show up in their town and perform, which is okay. I mean, now it's not okay because no one can perform. But I think that there's... So one of the solutions I had... and you can imagine this as like universal basic income. So universal basic income is the government giving everyone money. And if we did that, then musicians would make more music and they wouldn't be starving to death and people would have more money to patronize them and support them. But I think the move we have to make is something where we empower consumers to pay artists directly just by virtue of listening to them or having their attention. Like, every American has like 100 music bucks or media bucks that they have in any given month. And by virtue of them listening to you, you actually get maybe whatever the streaming, like, you know, pennies are, but you get like a micro fraction of that person's music bucks for that month times all of the folks that listen to it. And then all of a sudden the money that goes to these 7 million artists in Spotify like goes up significantly. This is like a revved up version of these public grants you're talking about, where instead of giving it to the artist, we give it to the consumer so that when the consumer listens to a musician or supports a musician, then the musician gets rewarded. Like, you would need some kind of system like that, which is actually very doable. Like, you know, it's much more doable now than it would have been in another time.
Yeah, or even, you know, I was listening to a podcast. Do you know the Revolutions podcast, Mike Duncan?
I don't listen to it, but I've heard of it.
It's an incredible podcast. But you know, it's like he seems so like stressed. It's always just, and like Harry's razors and all this. And I'm like, why can't there just be a donate a dollar? Like, why can't I just buy
it? Just donate the dollar. And like watching artists scramble for this stuff too and be like, hey, support me on Patreon, support me on this and that. It's like, you know, it's like if I enjoy your stuff, you should just be getting value from me.
I just feel like every single streaming service, like even like YouTube or whatever, Spotify, there should just be a little thing at the side of like the song, yeah, or the podcast or the video, and it's like, I just want to donate a dollar to this. Because another thing that I was thinking about a lot is music videos, for example, and I know you wanted to talk about K-pop, which I think is sort of, anyway, so like the music video masterclass at the moment, but
yeah, they've taken it to a whole other level. It actually reminds me of your stuff where it's very transporting, but go on.
But you know, it's like, so music videos, there isn't a direct you don't directly profit from a music video. You like pay for a music video and you just like hope to God like it makes a song take off or whatever, and that you can like earn the money back on the video. And like, I think this is, it's kind of sad because it's like, I feel like the art of music videos would be respected more if like you could pay for them in an easier way. Like when I see a fucking fantastic music video, I'm like, damn, like why can't I just give them $2 or $5? Like, you know,
there are so many problems that are tied into this, but one problem is that our attention is being monetized in various ways. We're conditioned not to pay, yeah, but then we pay this hidden price because you're selling ads and you're selling my data and you're doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
Like particularly in the social media world. I mean, a lot of this music we're talking about is on YouTube. Like freaking, you know, YouTube tries to monetize us through ads, and they've got very effective algorithms and rabbit holes. And some of that stuff's not great. You know, like there's a joke that you're always three clicks away from a conspiracy theory on YouTube. Like, start out watching a video, then you'll wind up, you know, watching some crazy video about pizzerias or whatever.
I don't know if this is like a proposed idea, but I've been thinking about this a lot lately. Like, you know, I feel like under capitalism, like we value things that we pay for more than things that we don't pay for. And, you know, like, do you ever get into like the am I the asshole page on Reddit? It's like a page where people like they come and they like say they're like, okay, am I the asshole, and they like say their situation, and like there's so many of them with like, you know, like a stay-at-home mom, like, you know, where the husband or whatever is just like you're the stay-at-home mom, it's an easy life, like blah 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 blah, like everything is paid for, like chill, like you're not allowed to complain. And you know, I really started thinking about the fact that motherhood isn't compensated. And it's this weird thing.
Oh my gosh, yes. Like motherhood is the hardest thing in the world. And so, then everyone treats it like it's hard. It's like, not. It's brutal.
It's way harder than a regular job. Like as a person, like I thought I was like a hard ass, like touring and, you know, just like it, when you're just like alone with a baby for 24 hours, like you can barely go to the bathroom. Like it's crazy. Like there aren't other jobs where it's just like going to the bathroom could just be like a huge problem. And like, you know, like sometimes you're just holding a baby in your arms crying and you're like, I just need to pee. Like, you know, it's like a really intensive job. And I feel like people, our society super undervalues it. And, you know, it's actually one of the most important jobs. Like it's like raising the next generation.
What does Canada do for new moms? Because Canada has paid leave and whatnot. The US is the most pathologically anti-woman and anti-family. And when Evelyn had our first son, Christopher, it was so difficult for both of us, but primarily for her, because when you're the dad, the baby doesn't care about you. You know, like the baby's homed in on mom and food.
Yeah.
And like the dad, like, you know, I was in the way a lot of the time. But seeing what Evelyn went through and then trying to help and being, you know, not, you know, like as much help as I wanted to be. It's so educational, like, cause I saw what Evelyn was going through where like the baby, needed her 24/7. The baby did not sleep more than, you know, what I forget what the rhythm was, but
an
hour. And then, and half the time, even when it was sleeping on top of her. And so, you know, she was like kind of half asleep the baby. And so she was just getting, it was so punishing. And imagining a single mom going through that really broke my heart. It's actually why I ran for president, because I was cocky going into it. I was like, there are two of us and we're, you know, like we have resources and the rest of it. And like, it should be fine. And then it was like a bomb went off in our house. And like, we both were losing our minds for months. And I just couldn't imagine someone going through it alone.
You know, that's the main thing. Like, 2 or 3 days in, I suddenly had this insane empathy and like deep concern for single mothers. Like, I was just like, oh, holy fuck. This would be like really, really bad if you were doing this on your own. And like, I think it actually might be, you know, people say single mom and this and that, but it like, that's like a really fucked up thing, I think. And I don't think as a society, like, we're considering that nearly
not enough at all.
Cause it's like, yeah, the level of brutality there is like crazy.
If you, going through it alone as a single mom, and right now 40% of American children are born to unmarried moms, you know, and then some
really?
Of them, yeah. So some of them, it looks like they're, you know, they're two parents in the homes. They happen not to be married, but in many of them, it's just a mom. Like it's the new normal really in the U.S. And it breaks my heart because like now I regard every single mom as a superwoman, superhuman. About 90% of single parents are single moms too. So when you think single parent, you're like, there are single dads out there, but they're outnumbered by single moms, like 9 to 1.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any single dad too. I mean, if you're, you know, you're in the same boat really. So, but I just like, I don't even know how you would have a job and have a baby if, and like not have another person. Like, I literally can't, like, what would you do?
Like, what would you do?
Yeah.
I totally agree. Like it's unfathomable.
It's pretty scary. So.
So we're talking about it now, but how is it XASH-A12? Like how did I pronounce that right? Or.
I say XAI Archangel because there was great dispute, I think around the world and in my house because I don't know. His name is malleable. I don't want to talk about him too much because I'm like really in the like wanting to de-celebritize him. I guess I really got in my own world. I didn't think his name would be that big of a meme. So like when it became like a giant meme, I was like, oh, like I already fucked my kid. And it's like,
no, don't worry about it. He's got plenty of time to become aware. Trust me, you know, I've got two boys and they don't know what the heck is going on even now. And they're like, you know, 5 years older than him. So you're fine. Don't worry about it.
I feel like it's like a consent thing. Like a baby can't consent to being like famous or whatever. So I'm like very cognizant of, trying to keep his life normal and not have him be like a celebrity baby or whatever.
Does he have the beginnings of a personality? Like, is he doing his thing?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's what's crazy. Like, personality seems almost there from day one, more like day 20. But you know,
Well, one of the things that happens when you're a parent, you'll probably agree with this, I think, is that before you have children and you get this like nature versus nurture debate. You think like, oh, it's like they're both really important. It's like 50-50. And then after you have kids, you're like nature.
totally like he was smiling and like reacting to the helicopters and stuff like weeks before he was responding to people, and I was like, oh, okay, he's obsessed with aircraft, this seems like
the old block.
His personality is fully like he has his vibe and it's just there. Like, I don't think we could change it. Like, he enjoys what he enjoys. He literally has taste. There's music he hates. Like, there's music he loves. Like, it's just like fully set, you know. I'm sure you could like,
Oh, I have the same experience where, you know, like our boys are very, very specific and that has nothing to do with anything we did, you know, like so parents think it's more nature than nurture. And apparently science agrees. Apparently science says there's a lot of
science does agree.
Yeah. Science does agree. It's a bit more nature than nurture. So it's not our imagination.
Hold up. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
So you just had an album come out. The creative process, I can't imagine what that's like for you. I have a couple of things that I work on, but like for you, I feel like you have to be absorbing images and music and just consuming culture in a particular way, because then at some point you're going to produce a video, an album. And there was a quote from you that I loved. It was something like, I don't want to just be the face of this thing I produce. I want to build it. Like, it sounds like you really have your elbows deep into everything that you're doing. So I feel like to do that, you have to be this kind of sponge where you're synthesizing art and music. Maybe not all the time because everyone needs a break, but like, I feel like that must be an important part of your work.
I'm just like constantly obsessively consuming new music and, books or movies or whatever. It's really important to me. It's actually like one of the reasons I did the, I don't know if you saw like the, I recently released an app that's like an AI.
Yes. I wanted to talk about this. It was like, yeah. The digital avatar that people could use.
It's like, it creates AI. It's like an AI music generative thing that makes audio for babies. But part of the reason I did it is like all the baby shit is so, I just feel like it's not good art. Like, I find it like distressingly obnoxious. And like, it was stressing me out because I was like, man, I can't keep like engaging with all this bad art in order to raise my kid, because it's going to make me a worse artist. And also, I feel like it'll make him worse taste as well. But
that is so on point, because you just end up exposing yourself and your kid to this kind of crap for kids.
Some kids stuff is great. Like, we were watching Fantasia the other night, and I was like, wow, Fantasia is a masterpiece, like an utter masterpiece. Have you seen that movie, the old Disney movie?
Oh yeah, the old Disney, Mickey Mouse, the brooms, the whole thing.
Yeah, and did you know what? Fantasia was made in 1944, and if you watch it from the lens of the war, it like completely changes the whole thing. It's like, yeah, great film. But so I mean, some kids' content is, in my opinion, some of the best content. There's also just a lot of, more like the baby stuff, like getting babies to like open their eyes and you know like all the little cards where you show them the black and white thing to try to get them to learn how to focus. Like, I feel like that stuff is just feels weirdly mass produced and not very artistic, and I'm like, man, this stuff could be prettier and more beautiful.
Crimes. If you wanted to uplift that, you would be doing the world such a massive service. Because every parent goes through this, where you look up and you're like, okay, like, how old is my kid? What am I supposed to be doing? And then like, you go online and like buy some products and you bring them in. And a lot of it is not as human as it could be or should be. Like that, like there is not a lot of heart and soul in a lot of it. So if, and I know this in part because Evelyn went through some similar processes. And so what she did is she had like a scratch pad of product ideas. And the funny thing is that, by the time you turn to the product idea as a mom, like your kid has aged into a need for another product. Yeah. And so you forget about that one.
My brother and I had this really funny one that like no one would ever want. But do you know like brutalist architecture?
Yeah.
Like, so it was called Brutalist Baby, and like everything would just be like cement, like hyper minimalist.
Some parents that would be into that for sure.
I feel especially like
World we're in now, they'd be like, oh, this is gonna make my kid more rugged.
Maybe it's like bad for the kid though, to be, maybe it's sort of like prison-esque, I don't know. But yeah, I'm like super into brutalist architecture at the moment, and I thought like Brutalist Baby, like, you know, like just like a square cement crib would be kind of cool.
Well, one of the things you and I were bonding over, which I think we need in the world, is that we need more public art. Like, and one of the fun things about you is like you're continuously like posting kind of visions and images of various structures and sculptures that should or could exist in the world.
Have you been to Burning Man?
I have not. I have many friends who've been. I take it you've been?
Yes. And like the thing that struck me the most about it is it's just like art everywhere. And it's just like, it just feels amazing to just be walking through. And there's also no obviously sound restrictions. So it's just like every half a block, there's just like a whole new audio experience. And there's just like beautiful art everywhere. And I'm just like, man, imagine if our cities had this much, like if you were just allowed to go make something and just put it there without all the bureaucracy and paperwork and like, you know, like even I wanted to like mural my house or like paint it black or something. And like, I had to go through the city council and it was like a whole thing. And I was like, okay, fine. I'll just have a normal house. Like, you know, cause if it's going to be such a trial, it's going to devalue the neighborhood and whatever, then fine. I won't like have a cool house, but like that's, you can't even like mural your house.
We should be able to mural our houses. In all seriousness, I think public art at a bigger scale would be really transformative. Because right now, one of the problems with America is that we're cynical about our ability to change and evolve. You know, and that's something around like a level of optimism and appetite for change in a positive way. And I genuinely think that art can produce that in people. Like if you were walking around a neighborhood and then that, like, I guess in your case, like there's like a house with a giant black mural and you're like, what the heck is that? And then it makes you like think for a second.
It just does. Like I was in Berlin recently to work on the app actually. And like, there's just a lot more public art in Berlin. And I was just like, man, this just feels cool. Like it just makes my day a bit better. Like it's just a bit,
it's uplifting. You know, like you're just more likely to be positive. You're more likely to be kind or generous or give someone the benefit of the doubt when they cut you off or whatever the heck it is. Like, you know, you're just like more positive. To the extent, aside from Burning Man, which I understand, like, you know, I mean, that would be like a singular experience. Are there American cities that actually are like not terrible at this, where you go and you're like, okay, like this place kind of reminds me of of Berlin in that way, or something like that?
I'm trying to think. I mean, there's cities like Detroit or Baltimore or Montreal where there's just a lot of abandoned stuff. And so there's a lot of like cool sort of illegal spaces where artists are residing. Like I'm less familiar with this now, but more like when I was in my like super whatever underground touring days. And it's not like public, but it is like sick. Like,
you know. Detroit, there are murals everywhere because there are like, there are buildings that have fallen into blight and disrepair and no one cares what the heck you do. So there are people going around.
Miami during Art Basel, which I think they paint over the murals during the year. I'm not sure, but like, it's sick to just like blocks and blocks of murals. It's just, I'm like, this is nice. You know, it's just cool. And then they were kind of having mural painting parties too, where people were painting murals and there'd just be a bunch of people sitting around like drinking and like chilling, like while the artists were painting the murals. And I was like, I don't know, it's just nice. Like if I had a Sunday afternoon off and I was walking around and I saw someone painting a mural, like I'd probably sit there and watch and hang out. Like nice. It's like a community building vibe exercise.
Yeah. In your case, you'd probably sit there and be like, you know what? You should probably go in this direction over there. And they'd be like, oh yeah, you're right.
No, I don't want to backseat drive. That's the worst when someone's like, if I'm DJing and people come up with requests, I'm like, oh, you know, don't want to backseat drive to other people's art.
You'd be like, just enjoy my vision. Get back to the dance floor.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill.
But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
So I have only recently discovered K-pop because, you know, I'm like an adult dude or whatever. but now that I've discovered it, oh my gosh, like I'm convinced that they've like discovered parts of our brains that they've like activated something really primal and fundamental in us where you can just watch that stuff and just like almost fall into like a trance.
I feel like I was thinking about this the other day. I was talking to my friends the other day and about my friend like was doing some art and she was like, oh, but it's so wholesome and there's no dark. And it was just this really like, everything was like pink and stuff. And I was like, I don't know, dude, like, I feel like this is like radically wholesome. And it's like being wholesome is actually sort of like, especially in art, is sort of looked down upon and like, you're supposed to be a tortured artist or whatever, but it's like, it's actually kind of edgy to be wholesome at this point. And I sort of feel like with K-pop sometimes it's just, it's like radically wholesome. Like it's just like nothing about it is abrasive. And like, I think that's actually like kind of a good thing. Like, I feel like we almost like don't have enough of that. Like it's like nice to just like know I'm gonna like vibe in and engage with something that's just gonna like sound great, it's gonna look great, it's gonna be positive, it's like about love, like there's like dancing, like it's just, and it's just gonna be executed at a flawless level. It's like, I feel like it's sort of a, well, I was gonna say underrated, but clearly not anymore.
Well, it's like the artists are kind of frozen in time at a particular age and stage. You know, if you had to trace the age, you'd say something like 16 to 26. I mean, I don't know if that's actually how old they all are. And then the music's aimed at a particular demo that's, you know, kind of similar. But it's also kind of frozen in time. Like, it reminds me of Michael Jackson and then Bruno Mars on top of Michael Jackson, or at least that BTS song that now is on the radio everywhere, where there, to me, and this betrays, you know, I grew up in the 80s or whatever, but it gives me like this wholesome 80s vibe, and I happen to have been in my teens during the 80s, so it's like it's like transporting back to that point. I think Elon and I are like, not, you know, like around the same age. I guess he might have a year or two on me. So I feel like they've really figured, they've like decoded something. They, you know, and I mean, they've now formed this billion-dollar creative industry, like powerhouse industry, out of Korea. Did you see the Blackpink documentary that's on Netflix? It's like about the kind of training and formation.
No, there's a Blackpink documentary on Netflix.
Yeah, wow, and you really
watch that.
Yeah, like, but so that they're like, it's great and mostly wholesome and the rest of it, but it also shows the way these girls, and they were girls at the time, I got identified and recruited and trained at essentially this boot camp that goes 12 hours a day, like 13 out of 14 days, where they get taught how to sing, dance, speak Korean, like generally traffic in this way. And like, and it also talks about how girls get weeded out on the regular, like they're there. And then, you know, the person that they were brought in with disappears, and like they come up and they're training for this debut, and they're training for this debut like 5 years later or whatnot. Like they have this archival footage of them showing up as 16-year-olds or whatever it is, and then they're like debuting at 21. You're gonna love it, like, is, you know, you're gonna know.
Okay, you know, I that is like, you know, yeah, that's the directly exactly what I'm looking for at this moment in time.
Holy cow, can they dance? Like they can dance, yeah. Like freaking they're almost like AI. The entire thing, actually, K-pop kind of reminds me of AI.
I mean, I think they're just really well trained. You know, it's kind of like the the Beyonce thing or whatever, they're just trained from a young age, so they're just like actually super pro. Like a lot of musicians like me or a lot of the people I know, like I was 24 when Grimes kind of took off, you know, and I had put like very little effort into training as an artist, or you know, I'd never even taken a single
look at this Grimes one. Oh, of the boys just emerged. Look at this.
How's it going,
Christopher? Grimes, run away, Christopher.
Grimes
is daddy's friend. One thing that I know you were inspired by from one of your early albums, which I was a fan of too, was Dune. For you, was Dune the book, the early movie? Like, what was it? Because you're one of your early albums, you were pretending to essentially craft a soundtrack for Dune. You were like, oh, if this was my soundtrack to it.
Well, the tragedy of my life. So, like, my dream as a child, like, I was like, I want to direct the Dune movie. And like, even as a child, I respect a lot of things about the David Lynch movie, but it's not. Maybe this is sort of like.
Heresy.
Not supposed to say this. I don't love the David Lynch movie. I super love the book. Like I read the book when I was really young. Like my dad started reading it to me when I was like 5 or 6, and then I just like got obsessed with it and just like finished it like when I was like 6 or something. So it's this very formative experience to me. But yeah, I think Dune is like phenomenal. I know it's like, I guess, sort of problematic in some ways, or you know, I'm actually really excited about the new movie. At first I was like extremely bitter and I was like, fuck Danny Villeneuve and blah 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 or whatever. But honestly, the casting is great.
You probably wrap around a lot of these circles. Have you met Danny Villeneuve or any of these guys?
No, I've never met him. I may be saying his name wrong, but I recently
copied you, FYI.
But like weirdly, Timothée Chalamet is actually like a great actor. And like Zendaya, like I don't know, honestly, the casting in Dune is like almost perfect. Like it's probably what I would have done. So, but I'm so sad that it's been postponed. It was like I was like, this is like the light at the end of the tunnel, like of the pandemic, was going to Dune. Like, and I was, you know, going to rent out a theater for all my friends and everyone cosplay as a character from Dune. And I was going to be like a sandworm or an artistic interpretation of a sandworm. But yeah, huge tragedy that film release has been delayed.
What a glorious vision of this film premiere, or the private film premiere. Like, I hope this comes to pass, just delayed, you know, because like you in the sandworm costume would be funny. There'd be a lot of funny things to be had.
Are you a Dune fan?
I'm a Dune fan from the book. The movie didn't do much for me, which is kind of funny. But I loved the world building of the book. I think that it was very, very hard to make a good movie about that book, given filmmaking capabilities of like the 80s and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I love about Dune that I think is so interesting is it's like so far in the future, but it's sort of post-technological, you know, like AI is banned, thinking machines are banned. And so like people are doing sort of crazy mind enhancement and stuff to like make up for, you know, the technology bans, which is really, really interesting to me. Especially because like, I do worry we might get into a situation where like governments might start banning technology. Like, I think a lot of like the tech boom has been amazing, but also has been quite irresponsible from a safety perspective. And it like, you know, I'm worried if the degree to which, like if the irresponsibility continues, we might get into a place where like we're shutting down technology. Like, cause we just.
Right now that's like the overreaction that everyone can see coming. Because now there's so many people that do not feel like they're getting included by technologies. Forward advancement. And there is something happening where technology is consuming more and more of our time, more and more of our kids' time. Are you on TikTok?
On and off. I do find the algorithm to be unsafely addictive. So I'm...
Bingo. That's where I was going with it.
Yeah. Wait, was I texting you about that? Humane Technology Center for Humane Tech. Yeah, we were talking about Tristan Harris.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and you know, I think for example, like I was listening to a podcast with Tristan Harris, and I think it's Tristan, whatever, I'm saying his name wrong.
Tristan, that's right.
And you know, the guy who invented the endless scroll, you know, and it's just like a lot of this stuff is like really addictive, and also sort of like prioritizes hysteria and rage, and also just misinformation. And you know, I think it's like leading to not only like a political crisis, but a mental health crisis.
Yes, on all counts.
You know, I was reading this thing about how like you go on Twitter or whatever, and your brain is kind of getting the social chemicals, and you're like, feel like you're getting the social time, but you know, you're not like, there's different hormonal releases when you're actually in a room with real people, you know? And it's like, you're actually, you feel like you're getting a social experience, but you're really not. And so it's like, people are kind of having the byproducts of being quite isolated. Mention just the lack of sleep, like, you know, like these things, like you're on your phone late at night, like it's going to be harder to sleep. Like I think sleeping pill usage is going way up.
Yeah.
You know, which is leads to less REM sleep, blah, 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 blah. And all of this like feeds into like mental health crisis on top of, you know, all the political stuff and everything. But yeah, I it's quite concerning. And, you know, I was thinking the other day, I was talking to some people the other day about how, you know, it's like, we have global warming and then we have all these global warming scientists or whatever, or like we have pandemic and then we have all these pandemic scientists, but then we have tech and then there isn't like a tech safety community that's super large. Like it's quite small. It's quite
God, the extent that it exists, it's tiny. Like it's Tristan, yeah. The people that he has on the podcast, and that's well, a lot.
I think there's like Oxford. There's like some stuff at Oxford. Like but it's still, it's like, it's just not, you know, it's interesting that when people consider career in tech, it's all sort of like making the tech, and none of it is the sort of like the stuff about
the guardrails. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, especially like when we're getting close to AI and talking about AI, you know, it's like, it's going to be super important to have like as many people working on AI safety as much as actually just building AI.
This is one of the things I said on the trail, Grimes, is that I said, look, some of the most powerful technologists in the world have said to me that they want guardrails on AI because all the incentives right now are to go as fast as possible because we're competing against each other and the Chinese, and one of us is going to do something very regrettable. And so I would say to folks, it's like, look, if Elon is saying this or Sam Altman is saying this, then we really need to listen, because these are not people that frankly generally request guardrails, you know, like that. That's not
No, exactly. Like, you know, I mean, one of the things that really concerns me about the state of the government right now, you know, at the risk of sounding ageist, is we just have a lot of people in the government who are like very old. They didn't grow up with the internet. They're not super tuned into technology. Like, you know, there's people who are like getting they're not even checking their email, like in Congress and stuff.
They might never check their email in their entire life.
Yeah, like their emails get printed out and they read the paper and then like you know, and it's just like, this is like really concerning. Like, I don't think the government across the board has any understanding of technology. And that's part of the reason the Facebook situation is so out of control.
We can all see it's happening, and you don't want to be a jerk to be like, oh, like, you know, the olds don't get this stuff. But the fact is, the average age of a U.S. senator is 62. So like, how many 62-year-olds, you know, that like understand like the mechanics of these social media companies? Very few. And there has not been independent guidance on technology related issues in the U.S. Congress since 1995, you know, 25 years. So so they're completely out to lunch on this set of issues. It's corrosive for our democracy. It's corrosive for our mental health. And I've experienced these social media apps in a particular way where I ran for president and tried to use these apps to the best of my ability to make my case and compete and generate a following. And so I've benefited from them tremendously. But
I rely on them completely to run my business.
But I can very, very clearly see the downsides for users, where I think that I'm unusually good on them. And even for me, sometimes like I sense myself lapsing into like a Twitter vortex, or like, you know, like an hour or two will pass. And I'll look up and be like, oh wait, like I was supposed to do this other thing. It feels like you're being productive in a particular way and social in a particular way.
Well, so the huge reward, you know, the way it's been set up, like as Tristan Harris or whatever says, like it's just reward. We're like, ooh, like you hit the heart and go blue, like it, you know, like the squirrel, like there's, it's so set up visually to just like make your brain just be like tuned in, and it does feel semi-productive, or you know, you're like, oh, I'm learning things, but it's like a very shallow comprehension. You know, if you're getting a one sentence on a thing, it's like, ooh, like a fact, like are you even going to remember that? And there's no deep knowledge there, and I'm not saying this, like I don't want to say social media is all bad. Social media obviously is great, and you know, there's been a lot of like political organizing and stuff on it, so you know, it's definitely like, I'm not just saying like, you know, fuck social media, but
there are excesses, and the excesses are hitting teenage girls particularly hard.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the beauty stuff, I think is like concerning.
And I believe that TikTok is the most powerful of these in its own way. Like I just got on TikTok maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And holy cow, is that stuff powerful. Like you get in there and it's hypnotic. You know, you just end up seeing these videos of human beings like dancing.
I mean, humans are trained to want to look at human faces. You know, it's like consider the amount of portraits versus landscapes, you know, in the lineage of painting. Like we want to look at humans, like we're, you know.
I think it behooves most any adult who wants to understand what's going on with the younger generation to try and spend a few hours on TikTok just to see what the heck the kids are doing. Because it's like another language. It's like another visual and digital language. It's got a different energy and vocabulary, different people. You know, it's like, it's fascinating because like, you know, I've been on Twitter now for a little bit. And all the media and the journalists are on Twitter, and then you go on TikTok and it's like just actual like kids having fun.
I think it's great for music.
For you, for music, it would be, I'm sure, like a really useful fire hose. You could just like turn it on and like get stimulation in a particular way.
Well, and it's sort of, I think, a more natural, I mean, maybe there are, you know, the dark forces of major labels pushing certain songs or whatever, but like I, as far as I'm aware, like I feel like it's just people like dig a song has a cool vibe with a certain movement, and then like that song can kind of take off in a natural organic way, and I think that's pretty cool, because music is super over gate kept, and I think TikTok doesn't have that. I don't know, I might be wrong, but
there's a music discovery element, and there are like undiscovered artists who are just making their stuff there and getting found.
Are you gonna run again, do you think?
I'm almost certainly gonna run for something at some point. I've been pretty public about that. And I dare say it would be more fun the second time than the first time, because we'd start at a higher base. But the problems are just getting bigger and hairier and nastier, and I just wanna try and solve them for your son, for my sons, for everyone's kids. Because you and I are in a position where we're actually more able to make a difference in the world than, frankly, you know, like the vast, vast majority of folks. And so, like, I take that responsibility to heart. So, yeah, you're going to see Andrew Yang on some ballot somewhere, some campaign. I've got a couple of visions, but first things first, you know, we have right now, this might be too nitty gritty for you, but we're heading to Georgia for the Senate races, trying to win the Senate for the Dems.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then I may end up in the administration trying to tackle some of these social media problems you're talking about.
That would be cool. Yeah. If that does end up happening and you end up like, I don't know, like working with the Center for Humane Tech people or anything like that, like, and you need any help, definitely hit me up.
I will hit you up. That would be so fun, Grimes. What we'd do is we'd have this, you know, this message that we need to get out. And then you could help, you could like make some freaking incredible creative for it. We'll hit you up on that for sure. Look at that. You could be like the champion of the humane technology movement or the human tech movement. I would love it.
Cool. Yeah. Well, any way I can help, just let me know.